Hello, Pod. I'm Chris Hewitt, and welcome to another episode of our brand new regular, Lee Interviews, which rounds up those cracking chats we have every week with the movie world's best and brightest. We've got a triple bill for you this week, starting off with the wonderful Kristen Stewart, who makes her directorial debut with The Chronology of Water, a bruising drama based on the book by Lydia Yuknovich, and which stars a career-best Imogen Poots as Yuknovich as she makes her way through a challenging life. It's a film we gave 4 stars to, and Stewart's approach to directing is bold and uncompromising, telling a story in a strictly unconventional, non-chronological fashion. It's a hell of a debut, and when I chatted to her last October at the London Film Festival, we spoke about her approach to directing and how it's been shaped, or not, by the amazing directors she's worked with across her career. Here you go, Kristen Stewart. Enjoy.
Kristen Stewart, director of The Chronology of Water. Welcome to the Ampro podcast. How are you?
Great.
There's so much to talk about with this movie. But before we get into the movie itself, I want to talk about your journey towards directing. Because I'm guessing that this is something you've wanted to do pretty much since you got into the film industry, in a way.
Yeah. And yeah, I mean, I guess if I really think back on why that impulse was kind of in my bones from conception, is likely because the exchanges that I have with directors feel so emotionally congruent that, you know, image creation and kind of cultivating a, for lack of a more kind of elevated term, like a vibe, and making sure that the alchemy of the set, the cellular, you know, collaboration just feels like suddenly you start sharing a body. This sounds like kind of over-intellectualized. What I'm saying is how physical movie making is. It feels like, of course, like there's a lot of prep involved to make sure that when you get to set, the environment you've created is about discovery and not necessarily about execution.
I was
just as a little kid, when you find yourself on a movie set that is really singing, like really the chorus is in tune, there's nothing like it. You just feel like you're a part of this massive machine, this like emotional sort of bloodletting. And I knew that for me, there's not like a massive separation between acting and directing. My favorite directions of all time that I've ever received are nonverbal. It's a glance. It's like a look across the room going, I'm with you.
Okay.
Yeah.
And so whenever you started directing on this, is that the sort of director you wanted to be? The sort of directions and notes that you wanted to give were the same, nonverbal and creating that vibe? Was that something that you wanted to do? Was important?
Yeah, it's important to not kind of... It's really difficult to make sure that you don't, like, step in all the snow and blow away the butterflies. Like, a film crew comes in and just, like, destroys serenity.
Yeah.
You know, you come kind of like barreling through with your like trucks and everyone's, you know, it's difficult to remain delicate, and you really have to, because I'm such a fucking honey badger on everything. I'm like such a control freak. I've come in way too hot quite often. And so I was like, you know, allow a little bit of that passion to inform like some gusto, but at the same time, get out of everyone's way, because you want to kind of bury things for your collaborators to discover. And it's nice for them to think that they came up with it themselves. Where you're like, yep, but I put that there for you to find.
So you're lacing clues around the set to sort of trigger them into doing what you want to do without actually being prescriptive in that way. You're like a mastermind in some ways.
Yes, that's right. Yeah.
Let's go back to the sort of the beginning of this journey. So David Fincher was obviously a director that you worked with very early in your career. What was that experience like? Was he one of the first directors that really made you see what you wanted to do, what directing was possible? What was possible in directing for you?
I was such a little kid. I was so obsessed with being a sort of crew member on that movie. And it's a rigorous approach. I mean, I know that he's like well known for doing lots of takes, and it was my second film, and it was just following a movie that I had done like in Toronto with Rose Trochet, which was a teeny tiny little indie movie. And so the structure was so different. And I remember I liked the athletic approach. It was like so physical and kind of about like how long you could last and sort of breaking through initial impulses, letting the scene get kind of terrible before it gets great again. Mm-hmm. It's like every time you think, you know, actors are always obsessed with newness and kind of coming to something for the first time, but that doesn't always mean that it's the best one. You have to have faith in yourself that you are human and you will remain that way, even if you feel now that you're being repetitive or that you're kind of like chasing something that had occurred previously. It's like you can always push past that.
Yeah.
Embarrassment of repetition and be like, oh, I kind of said that already. It's like, okay, but anyway, so yeah, I mean, I guess with him, it was also kind of a two-part informative experience. I worked with Jodie Foster, who's an incredible director, yeah, and very, as an actor, kind of has my favorite. She's kind of one foot in, one foot out, because she's so aware of process and she's so present and honest, but at the same time, a technician.
Yeah.
And so really like leans into, it was just like really cool to watch the two of those people work at. I was 11 when I made that movie. I turned 11 on the movie.
Wow.
And I was like, okay, this is intense.
Yeah.
But no, I had a great time on that movie. I'm still here, you know. It was encouraging. I wanted to be an actor forever.
But then at that point, as you begin to make more and more movies, who's the director or directors that you really, that lit a fire under you in a way, in terms of, you know, harboring or sparking that desire to be a director?
Mm. Sean Penn, Kelly Reichardt, Olivier Assayas, Pablo Larraín. Like, truly, these people are, like, just mad. And I think with Sean specifically, he would just, like, pick up the camera himself and, like, run up a mountain. And if you could keep up with him, then that meant you were kind of, like, allowed to be in the movie. And so he, like, just infused that film with, like, his vitality, and I was like, holy shit. I just had never seen like such kind of like roughneck, impulsive, truly alive approach. And then with Kelly, she's just like the most, I mean, the movie that we did was quite composed, but it sprawls emotionally.
Yeah.
And I mean, River of Grass was like like one of my favorite. I mean truly, like I covet that woman's work. I can't believe I got to work with her.
So all the time you're harboring this desire to direct. And I know I read an interview with you where you said that you wish you'd done it sooner in a way. So was there anything that was percolating, bubbling around before The Chronology of Water came around for you?
The Chronology of Water was a real like seal breaker.
Yeah.
It's such an activating text. And it really invites a cinematic approach because the writing emulates a real memory wash dream state. And that's really what, I mean, cinema can come so close to what it feels like to have an internal experience. Mm. And one that is nonlinear, yeah. Like your memories or like your dreams, yep, when you go to sleep. And yeah, so this book in particular, I just thought had physicalized certain emotions that are secrets and kind of brought these underlying cacophonous feelings to this to a surface that I had absolutely never seen before. It was like the book's full of secrets and we all have them, and they are like so common, pervasive, absolutely everywhere, permeates the way that our bodies move through this world. And I just thought it was not a book about the things that happened to this woman, even though it is a memoir. And it's, you know, you could have made like a kind of biopic version of this and allowed the piece to be reduced to the elements of the plot. But what we wanted to do really was to be able to like deconstruct a life and then stitch it back together like a quilt. And so the movie had to have its own memory and its own body. And in order to like faithfully adapt the book, we kind of needed to break it. It's about form.
Mm.
that like sort of reorganization of details and prescribed stories, and just realizing that reality is so malleable and it is in your hands to change if things feel kind of like unsustainable, when the things that happen to you are sort of unacceptable, you can sort of reframe them and enjoy them and destigmatize things that are painful and kind of like step into taboo in a way that feels repossessive. I mean, this is a book about repossessing words through your body.
Yeah. Well, I was so taken by the rhythms of the film and the way you approached it visually. And I'm fascinated by the process of writing the movie, shooting the movie, editing the movie. Obviously, you know, you make a movie three times, essentially. And I know that you shot a lot more than you used in the edit. But were you always looking towards that sort of staccato, dreamlike rhythm, almost replicating the way that water moves in a way, capturing that dreamlike vision? Was that something that was in your screenplay, or was that something you discovered in the editing suite?
We pushed it in the edit.
Yeah.
There was a sort of trickle effect, kind of like a flip book of memories in order to blend time and not have it feel jarring.
Yeah.
We kind of figured out how to kind of tease an image before jumping into a new scene, because there was a sort of emotional catalytic occurrence in one scene that would sort of rocket you into the next.
Yeah.
And so if you didn't feel the reason for the trigger, I think it would have been kind of too abrupt and stark and weird, and the scenes. But we needed to make like a smoothie of a movie. It needed to blend. And there are patterns and repetitions realized visually that do, you know, step in for the kind of main central metaphor of the film, is that it's about breaking pattern. It's about reclassifying trauma and not allowing the things that echo to pull you under and destroy you. And so we needed those echoes, and then we needed to kind of we needed to find emotional connective tissue that felt discovered instead of planned, but we always planned to find that chaotically. I mean, in the script, there's all the flashes are written in there, but I think what ended up happening is the images changed because we found new ones.
Yeah.
And they were better than what I planned.
Did you find new ones on set or new ones in the edit suite as you were going?
New ones on set that we then brought into the edit and used.
Amazing. Wow.
Yeah.
And a lot of that will obviously come from your interaction with your actors as well. The work that Imogen does in this movie is phenomenal.
It's insane.
Yeah. she's a national treasure over here.
Oh my God, really? Because I say that all the time. I was so happy to come. I was so happy to premiere the movie here last night because I knew like her whole family was in the audience, and you know, I just was like.
Yeah. I don't think there's nothing she can't do. I don't think. She's amazing. But
I want her to do a one-woman show.
Just on anything at all, or anything that pops into her head, or would you write this one-woman show?
No. She has to write it. This is all about her. Absolutely. Yeah.
Would you direct it?
God, I'm really showing my. I'm really like tipping my cards. there's something that I want to make with Imogen that's kind of percolating right now, that I would want to make a kind of meta-textual scenario in which she played herself trying to do a one-woman show, but like in a sort of. Well, let me pitch you the movie. Ready? Here it goes.
I'm ready.
I'm not going to do it. I'm going to keep this one. Shut up. But
I'm ready to green light it. You know,
I have two things for Emmy that I'm sure it would be a huge mistake to not do. So I have to push those forward.
Amazing. Because I know that, was this a role that you might have played?
No.
Ordinarily? No?
No. I mean, look, if somebody sent it to me, I would probably have jumped on it, but... Yeah, I mean, I have a different, there's like a kind of luscious, there's kind of a luscious, vicious openness that Imogen has. I think I think she just really represents this kind of like, she's got a sensuality, but she's so pragmatic and she's so strong, and she's got such a formidable physical presence while being somebody who's really shy and vulnerable also. Like, mm-hmm. she covers it up with her kind of like British Muppet, but but really it's not. She's a delicate creature.
Yeah.
She's so hyper intelligent. I mean, to cast a writer is really difficult because like you just can't fake it. I mean, she's somebody who becomes a, at the end of the movie, you should believe that this woman can, you know, spit some wisdom and who actually reads, you know, no one does yes. that anymore. She's, yeah. No, it was never me. I'm just like way sharper. I just have way more edges. She needed to be this like soft, open, like kind of sometimes a little bit blurry maniac. Like she just, but yeah, I just think she's so perfect for this part. When I saw, she auditioned for the movie, which blew my mind because I've just been such a obsessive fan for so long. And I thought maybe it would be cool to discover someone that we had never seen before. So the net was like so wide. And then it was like, hire the best actress you've ever met. That's maybe the best. That's the best idea.
So it was an unnecessary audition.
100% halfway through. I was like, please stop. We need to be filming this. Yeah, this is insane. Stop it.
When did you first meet her? When did you first recognize what you were working with?
Ah, gosh. I mean, I saw her in everything she's ever really done. I mean, she's like so incredible in Green Room. And we have a bunch of mutual friends, oddly. There was like, it was bizarre that we had never actually crossed paths. She sent me an audition tape. I mean, it was like just in the slew of, it was in this very large pile of self-tapes. And yeah, I mean, there was just like never anyone else. And then I was in London. I think we were doing like Spencer stuff. And I had like stayed up all night before our meeting. And it was like, I was half a person when I met her. And I think she had read the book, but maybe not the script yet. And I could be wrong. And I don't know if you talked to her, but
yeah.
No, but we had a really great kind of weird fever dream of a meeting. And it was like, we're done here. I mean, we're going to work together for the rest of our lives.
So talk to me then through the process of directing her and working together to get this performance. Was it a lot of nonverbal glances and the directions that you talked about earlier on? Did that manifest in this movie?
Yeah, but I also think I was a little up her ass. Everyone else, like, whatever, but she... it's such a dual performance. I mean, like, we're both in this movie. We were really in lockstep. And she had so... I mean, she had to traverse, like, 4 decades of a life.
Yeah.
And trust me, we didn't shoot it in order. I mean, we were all over the place. She would play, like, 18 and 40 in the same day. And there was a lot of dialogue. I think it was like, for me, she would come to set and I'd be like, okay, do you remember this part of the script? So it's when this happens and then before this happens and then after this happens. But I would like, I guess I would make her do it over and over and over and inevitably use like take one or two because I just couldn't, I couldn't see. I just like wanted to make sure that we dug and dug and dug and got to the very bottom.
Yeah, yeah.
But her first instincts were much better than the way that I sort of dragged her around.
And what's next for you beyond directing Imogen Poots in a metatextual one-woman show?
Oh, God, so cool.
If I had the money on Greenlighter right now.
Honestly, I want to do it for absolutely nothing. I want to do like a weird communist version of a movie set where my whole crew is like basically working for free, but I make not a dollar. And then you go, cool, if this movie makes anything at all, it's all yours. Thank you for your 3 weeks.
I like that.
I know. We can do it tomorrow.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I don't know. I'm trying to figure out how to do stuff like that. I'm trying to figure out kind of how to like break away from the system of the industry and change process. Because if we keep emulating the same process, we'll keep making the same film over and over. Mm-hmm. And I think reality is breaking for us all. So it's time to kind of redesign it.
Damn straight. What a pleasure it's been. Kristen Stewart, thanks so much for your time.
Hell yes, dude. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, that was Kristen Stewart, and a reminder that The Chronology of Water, which is not part of a loose unofficial trilogy with The Weight of Water and The Shape of Water, is in cinemas now. Also in cinemas right now is the film directed by our next guest, because you can still find a cinema showing Jared Bush's Zootropolis 2, after all, at $1.7 billion and counting at the global box office since it opened late last year. It is the biggest animated movie of all time and can still pack them in to auditoriums. But as time in cinemas is winding down, and as time on PVOD has just begun. And so it was the perfect opportunity to talk to Bush, who wrote and co-directed the sippy animal-based sequel to Oscar and BAFTA-nominated Effect, and possibly winning Effect as well, when he flew into London early this week. And I went along and had a lovely natter with him about the success of his movie, about Nick Wilde, Judy Hopps, major A-list cameos, and much, much more, including, as it turns out, my surname. Enjoy. We are delighted to be joined on the Emperor podcast by the writer and director of Zootropolis 2, Jared Bush. How are you, sir?
I'm doing great.
Good, good, good. I hear you just landed.
I literally just landed like 45 minutes ago.
Okay. How are you? Are you all right?
I mean, this is the best. Are you kidding? This is it's literally travel's my favorite thing, so being here is fantastic.
What about being taken from a plane straight into a hotel room to talk to idiots like me? Is that your favorite thing?
Well, see, you're talking to an idiot like me, so I think we both have that working for us.
Oh, our idiocy will cancel each other's
yes,
idiocies out.
This is not going to go well.
That's always a good start.
Yeah.
I wanted to talk about Hewitt, first of all. Which is my surname.
Yeah.
And it's your son's first name.
It is.
And your son voices a character in Zootropolis 2.
Yeah.
Talk us through that. And also, I've never heard Hewitt as a first name before.
Yeah.
So, this is very self-indulgent.
Sure.
But I need to hear the story behind that.
First off, name for you. You know, we've been big fans forever. So that's how that happened.
Of course. Yeah.
Well, I can tell you. So my son Hewitt, who's 18, in the first Zootropolis, like 12 years ago, he must have been 5 years old at the time. We had a very different version of the story back then. And he played this little adorable polar bear and had like a major part because it's not like there's 5 year olds everywhere. And then we did a story change and I had to fire my own son at age 5. And so he now plays Armpit Pete, who's a lizard that shows up in the reptile bar in Nick Wilde's armpit. And that was my way of apologizing for firing a child.
Wow. Yeah. Okay. What was that conversation like?
It wasn't great. Wasn't great. Because it turns out 5 year olds don't understand story changes very easily.
I guess they don't. I guess they don't. Oh, well, I'm glad you patched things up. That's good.
We did.
Very, very quickly. Hewitt as a first name?
Yeah.
Is that that's an amazing.
Yeah. You know what? I'd say
more
that
people should do this.
I first off, we love the name. We spent a long time, my wife and I, trying to figure out like what would we name my son. Hewitt was just a name that for some reason just kept on popping up. I'd say that for me, we wanted something that felt unique, and he's a unique guy, so it's perfect.
Fantastic. Excellent stuff. Well, let's move on to congratulations now, shall we?
Yeah, because, perfect. Now that we're done talking about my son, let's get to me. Thank you.
Because I think you've been nominated for, everything, right?
I mean,
this is
right.
Oscars, BAFTAs, Golden Globes, Emmys, Grammys, World Darts Championships. You've done them all. This is amazing. Congratulations on that.
Thank you very much.
And also, I mean, the incredible success at the box office. This movie has taken, last time I checked, about $1.7 billion.
Yes.
That's not bad, Jared. That's not bad at all.
It is one of those things where it doesn't seem real, you know? I'd say that one of the things that everyone at Disney Animation is excited about, like 700 people worked on this movie. And the thing we're most excited about is we talked so much about trying to make a movie that would bring people to theaters. It has to be worthy of getting people off their couches into a theater. And when we see those box office numbers, that just means people are going out to see it. And the best part is, usually that means at this stage, it means people are going to see it again. Which is amazing because so many little details have been put in there by our artists, like these little Easter eggs in every single moment. And to me, that's one of the most exciting things because people are starting to pick up on those.
So, yeah, because there's so many background gags.
Yeah.
You wrote this as well. And I imagine one of the reasons why it took 9 years to make Zootropolis 2 is because you were going through every possible permutation of animal-based pun. You can think of, because they're all in here.
I wish I could take credit for all those puns. I will say 100% that is a team effort. I think a lot of people don't realize that, like, as we're going through, before I got to Disney Animation, I was like, how long are these scripts? Because there's so many jokes all over the place. How is it possible? And it's just everyone adding their own two cents and their own jokes and their own little bits throughout the entire process. So Corey Loftus, who's our production designer, any sign you see in this world, largely, he's the one that made that sign. And he may like puns more than I do, which is saying a lot. It's a sickness for him. And so for me, as Byron and I, my directing partner, would watch it, we kept on seeing signs we'd never seen before. Like, once the movie was done, like, in theaters, I'm like, oh, my God, I didn't know that pun was there. So,
oh, really?
Yeah, he's a madman.
Okay. So things like, for example, in the... in the opening action sequence of the film, yeah, there is the nitrous oxide canister of gas.
Yeah, yeah.
Is that a Jared Bush pun, or
I wish I could take credit for nitrous oxide.
Take credit.
Yeah, sorry, it was all me. No, I believe that was probably Corey. That seems like a Corey special, but it could have been another one of our visitive artists. Yeah, I mean, we had the joy of sitting there and we're going through scenes and someone says, how about this idea? And you're like, immediately, 100%, yes. It's such a fun, joyful, playful world to spend time in. And I think everyone that touched this movie knew that and just wanted to go in there and have a great time.
Did it take a long time to crack this nut?
Yeah.
And at what point did you really begin, at what point did it begin to come together for you properly?
I mean, honestly, it's a great question. Our movies take about 5 years from sort of the nugget of an idea until it's in a theater. So on this one, everyone looks at 9 years and says, oh man, 9 years, that took a long time. Byron and I, my directing partner, and Yvette, our producer, after Zootropolis 1, we went and did Encanto. So that was 5 years on Encanto. And then the remaining 4 or 5 years was Zootropolis. So for us, weirdly, that time skip is almost a blink. Like, I don't think of it as being that much time that went by. I will say that early on, we knew that we wanted to tell the story of reptiles coming to the city. That would be the big part of the mystery, even as we were working on the first one. Reptiles weren't a part of it. It was this mammal.
Was that a conscious choice in the first movie to leave them out?
Okay. Yeah. And the big reason for that, we talked about bias and stereotypes specifically between predator and prey animals.
Yeah.
In the mammal world, that delineation is very clear. Mm-hmm. And for birds and for reptiles, predator and prey is a little squishier because there's sometimes kind of both of those things.
Yeah.
And so as a result of that, we wanted to just focus on the very clear mammal divide for that. But we knew that there's reptiles out there. And so really the question was, what kind of story can we tell? And we knew that we wanted to continue this, I don't know, to dig into this bias and stereotype. And that really became a story about differences, specifically between a mammal and a reptile. But of course, this is a relationship story. So you have Nick and Judy, who are very different types of animals, but the way they see the world is very different. And in our world right now, talking about differences felt really important.
Can you talk about the writing process for you? Do you shut yourself away? Do you sit down? Because the plots of these things, I mean, obviously there's lots of nods to things like Chinatown and whatnot and film noir.
Yeah.
And as a result, they're very labyrinthine. So do you have to get all your T's crossed and your I's dotted before you can sit down and write a word?
Honestly, it's one of the things I love the most about Disney animation. So in those 5 years it takes to make one of our stories, at the very early stages, the first year, and you're outlining, you're coming up with story points, you're pressure testing that with other folks, typically a writer, in this case me, but in other movies, sometimes that's more than just one person, starts to then work on a first draft. Once you get that first draft of a script in, you don't have another finished draft until the movie's in theaters, because you're constantly changing it, it's evolving. Over those 5 years, you're screening it internally about 6 to 8 times.
Yeah.
In storyboard form. So not final animation, storyboard time version of that.
Yeah.
When you do that, you find things and people have better ideas, or you say, we can beat that thing, or, it's just not coming together the way I wanted it. So it's constantly being reinvented. And so as a writer, for me, it's a wonderful place because you get to iterate constantly. That's honestly my favorite thing to do.
What's the last major piece of the jigsaw that fell into place, and how late did it fall into place?
Oh, man. Well, the pro and con of animation is you can go pretty late sometimes.
The movie's finished, just to double check.
Okay. I know. Yes, I think that's true. I'd say that the biggest significant thing was we did a story structure adjustment so that our midpoint, about a year ago right now, so not that long ago.
Oh, wow. Okay.
A story adjustment where the midpoint used to be that Burning Mammal Festival, and we changed it, put the Burning Mammal Festival at the end of the second act, and the midpoint became them climbing up a cliff and going to that honeymoon lodge where the pen was destroyed and they're separated. That was an idea that came in about a year ago.
Oh, really?
And the reason for that was we had them at the end of the movie, that big moment where they have this conversation, sort of both of them say how they really feel about each other.
All the neuroses come out and they self-diagnose.
Right. So that had been a scene for about 3 years. but we needed to earn it. And so the reason we changed that midpoint was because we needed some other stepping stones. So by the time you got to that moment, it felt organic and real and emotional. And we needed a bunch of other stepping stones to achieve it.
So had you always separated them for the second half of the movie?
Yeah. It was always separation. But how that happened, why that happened, was it a conscious decision or not? Those were things that we would pressure test. Sometimes if you pushed Judy and she said, I'm leaving intentionally, then you're like, well, she would never do that. Why would she do that? Or same thing for Nick. It just doesn't feel organic. So it had this moment where they just had this argument. So emotionally, they were feeling separated, but they weren't physically separated. But then the plot separated them, felt like the best way to do those things.
Yeah, and then to have them pulled apart at that point. Because at that point as well in the movie is your voice cameo and Byron's voice cameo as well.
Thank you for noticing that.
Some outrageous accents going on there, Jared.
Yeah. I think you mean beautiful, sophisticated. Are those the words you were looking for?
Nuanced.
Tasteful.
Tasteful.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Well observed.
Yeah.
Also.
Yeah.
Was that also in there as well?
The goats came at the same time. So about a year ago, the goats came into this movie. Part of that was something you find is as you're going through, we had these really heavy scenes. We had the end of the movie, very heavy for a while. We knew that that breakup was going to be really heavy. So we felt like we needed a little bit of a lift because we'd just gone through this crazy chase through these water tubes. That was, I mean, to me, it's so, there's a lot of drama in that, but we found if you went straight from that drama and that anxiety into another tense scene, then the audience didn't have time to take a break. So the idiot goats were there designed to give you a little bit of a break and to say, man, they could have done better with that voice acting. And they were right. And then back to Judy and Nick.
You guys knock it out of the mountain park. There's no question about it. Was that something that it was always going to be you guys doing the voices?
No. I'd say this movie has like 71 speaking parts. It's the most we've ever had, ever, I think. And so we were going back and forth like, well, maybe we could find somebody else, but literally just ran out of time. And we're like, all right, well, we're idiots and we can probably pull this off. And both Byron and I took a lot of German when we were growing up in junior high and high school. Uh-huh. And so I think we had a kinship to these guys. and last year, unrelated but perfect, was the first time I've ever worn lederhosen. So it all came full circle for me.
Was that for the voiceover gig?
It wasn't.
Or was it unrelated?
No, unrelated but perfect.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, you've that's got for another day.
No, and even though, when did you wear a lederhosen?
I was at Oktoberfest.
Okay.
And it's the first time I'd gone. Mm-hmm. It was in preparation for this movie eventually coming out, but I was not expecting to be in lederhosen last year. But there I was. My wife did not approve of those pictures.
Amazing. So you say 71 speaking parts.
Yeah.
And one of the things I love about the movie is that some of those speaking parts are incredibly famous people who get maybe one line at best.
Yeah, one word sometimes. Yeah,
one word sometimes. Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, Dwayne Johnson as the Dick.
Yeah. Yep.
Seek the Dick.
Yeah.
How did that come about?
He's one of my favorite people. And obviously he and I spent a bunch of time on the Moana films. As we were thinking about what would be very silly, I was like, who could this Dick be? And I went, I don't know. And so I texted, hey, would you like to be a Dick in Zootopia, in Zootropolis 2? And I think the amount of time it took for him to respond was 3 seconds. And it was, of course, it was immediately a yes. That was the easiest yes, I think, of the entire cast.
And then when he comes in for 10 minutes, 20 minutes, an hour, a day?
No, actually, but I think that's the only, of everybody, that's the only actor, because he was somewhere else. And he goes, I'll just send you something.
Okay.
And he did, because he was on set for another movie, and they just, I don't know what movie it was, but he's like, hold on a second, guys, I need to record some Dick lines. And then that was sent to me, and it went straight into the movie.
In the wrong hands, that can sound very, very bad. But yeah, I get it. Did it, because my first question, if someone had asked me to be a Dick in a movie, I'd have gone, what's a Dick?
I did explain that.
Okay.
So he was aware. But I'd say, you know, what's weird is that we spend so much time doing research. The entire movie is research for us, so... it's not like there's a 2-month research period and we start to make the movie. We're doing research constantly. So actually, a Dick is one of my favorite animals. Like when we went on safari to Kenya, you'd see them everywhere. Nice. And they're the cutest little, they're like little antelope, but they're like the size of a tiny little puppy. And they run around, they're adorable. And so you know, I explained what that was, and that was great. But yeah, we did an audience preview, and everyone's like, yes, we know what that is. And so I was like, great. So we've mission accomplished for us.
And then, Dwayne, you get blown out of a tuba by an elephant.
Yeah, that's true.
We never see you again. You may die.
I think he says, please no, please no, no. And that's his entire performance.
And then someone says, is there anyone who's going to catch him?
Yeah.
So I'm worried about
Nicole Brown. And she, by the way, she ad-libbed that line. We were not expecting, because she was like, where'd that guy go? So she came up with that on the spot. But I mean, that's one of those things where it's, I think that as you're making a movie, something that a lot of people don't realize is you're hanging out with people that are really fun, and you're hanging out with your friends, and you're trying to make something that's going to make people laugh. And, you know, I think we're really lucky to have so many folks that just wanted to come and have a good time with us.
One of those people is Michael J. Fox.
Yes.
As Michael J. Le Fox.
Yeah, that took me a long time to get that one.
He took the day off after writing that.
Yeah.
Talk me through that. I mean, how that came about.
He's a legend in my childhood and growing. I mean, it's just one of my favorite actors of all time. So the idea of him doing a cameo was something that I had been chasing for years. Mm-hmm. I will say that the story shifted in a couple spots. And so at one point we debated, should the character he plays not be a fox? And we're like, what are we doing? How would we not have Michael J. Fox not be a fox? This is insanity. And so luckily Nick does get arrested and sent to jail. And there he is, Michael J. the Fox being a jerk to someone else, bullying them with a line from Back to the Future. So kind of perfect.
Yeah, absolutely beautiful. When you were talking about Dwayne there, you said just for a second, Zootopia instead of Zootropolis.
Yes, I did.
I'm guessing because obviously it has a different name in the States and here, I believe in Europe as well, it's Zootropolis. Obviously, you have to build it into the recording sessions as well. This could eat up valuable minutes, Jared. I mean,
it does.
So you have to get different takes, or do you just get the actor saying Zootropolis, or do you have to get the different takes of every single speech?
We do both of those things. So if it's really emotional, we'll have them do the line with the different version of the word. So obviously, in the States, it's Zootopia.
Yeah.
Here in the UK and some parts of Europe, it's Zootropolis.
Yep.
In France, it's Zootopie. In Germany, it's Zoomania. And in China, the official name of the movie is Crazy Animal City. That's the actual title of the movie there. So it gets changed every single place it goes. So if you watch and you see the signage in the back, even that has to change. So it's not just the word.
Wow.
If you see like City of Zootopia somewhere, in the version here, it says City of Zootropolis. Or if it's in Germany, it will just say there will be nothing there sometimes. So it is, for anything you see, it is customized so much. That's a real testament to our teams really working hard and being on top of it.
And do puns travel? So, for example, does nitrous oxide play as well, you know, over here or in Beijing, for example, as it does here or in New York?
This is the other crazy thing about our process. We do different puns around the world that will work for those places. And so we have like the greatest minds on the planet that are comedians that go, well, that pun will not work if it's not English because we don't have that pun.
Yeah.
We're going to change it to this very different thing. But in Germany, it'll be this and that will be funny there. And so we have a lot of trust and faith in those teams to do that. But the other great thing that I keep on hearing everywhere is people really understand what the tone of this world of Zootropolis is, which is, it is aged up. I mean, of course, it's a movie for everybody, but I think a lot of audiences go in that are adult audiences that hope they're going to be entertained. And so when you have people around the world trying to make sure that hits right, they're really aging those jokes up, which I appreciate.
My God, that process, Jared, sounds
a lot.
Punishing. Punishing.
Yep. If you're angling for a job in some future chapter, I think we're heading the right direction.
My people will talk to your people.
I love it.
After this, very, very quickly as well, I was really taken by the credit at the end, a film by everyone at Disney Animation. Can you talk about that?
I can. That's a real thing. You know, I think that you hear a lot that animation is a team sport, and it absolutely is. What that means is everyone that touched this movie made it better. And it's not just people in their individual fields. Like I was mentioning, over the course of the 5 years, we screen that internally. Our whole studio watches that, gives their feedback, gives ideas, ways to elevate, joke ideas or emotional ideas across the board. And so when I say, and you look at the credits and it says a film by everybody, everyone had to contribute to make this movie what it is. In a way that I think that level of collaboration, I've not seen it anywhere else in Hollywood or anywhere else in the world, that deep level of ownership by so many people that really worked hard together.
Amazing. And presumably, if you win the Oscar, they'll all come up on stage and it'll be...
It'll be 800 people. We're getting that cleared just in case.
They're going to have to reinforce the stage.
Yeah.
Oh, that'll be a hell of a thing. Jared Bush, on that note, I'm going to let you go, but it's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you so much.
It has been a pleasure. Thank you.
And thank you for spreading the name Hewitt out there.
I'm doing what I can for you and for other Hewitts out there.
Thank you. It is noted. Cheers, man. Thank you.
Okay, and that was Jared Bush, father of Hewitt Bush, the kid with the greatest name in the world. Hewitt as a forename. I'd never even thought of that. Genius. Anyway, he was talking about Zootropolis 2, which is still in cinemas and also now on PVOD. Go check it out. You will have a ton of fun. And last but not least this week, we have another Empire Podcast spoiler special excerpt, this time featuring a guest. That's right, it's Andrew Guest, the co-creator of Wonder Man, the latest Disney Plus MCU show, which stars Yahya Abdul-Mateen II as Simon Williams, an actor who has ambitions of playing a hero called Wonder Man, and Ben Kingsley as the legendary Trevor Slattery, an actor who forms a complicated relationship with Simon. All 8 episodes are now on Disney Plus, and it's truly unlike anything we've seen in the MCU to date. And I get into that right from the off with Andrew Guest in our long chat about the show. You're going to hear the first 15 minutes or so of that chat. And as ever, please don't listen to this if you haven't seen Wonder Man, as we get into spoilers from the off. All right, you got that? The rest of you can stick around and enjoy a guest called A Guest. We are delighted to be joined on this Empire Podcast spoiler special for Wonder Man by the co-creator and showrunner of Hollywood's latest brainwashing superhero opiate. It is Andrew Guest. How are you?
I'm well, Chris. Lovely to be here. Thanks for having me.
I've just quoted your own lines back at you, Andrew. How does that feel?
I love that. It's the first, well, you're the first person to catch up on that line and make something out of it. I love it.
Before we get into the show and we talk about what the show is, can we talk about what it isn't, first of all? Because what it isn't is a superhero show.
It is not. From the beginning, when I first met with Brian Gay and Destin and a few other folks at Marvel, the intention was to make a show that didn't feel like anything they'd ever done before, which was very exciting to me. And it was one of those things where I'm sure our listeners or you or even me at the time was like, yeah, they kind of mean that, right? You know, they want the appearance of something different. But when it comes down to it, when we get to episode 5, they're going to be like, this doesn't feel enough like the kind of thing we do. I kept anticipating that. And the thing I was very thrilled about was they meant it when they said it. And Lou and Kevin stuck to their guns. I mean, they supported us creatively top to bottom, which was just really extraordinary and lovely.
So in terms of that, because we'll talk about what it is in a second, but in terms of that, it's not a superhero tale in the conventional sense. We only get to see Simon use his powers a couple of times. There's one fight scene, if I'm right in thinking, in the entire Correct. 8 episodes. Obviously, the show ends how it ends, which is really cool and interesting. But we don't get an origin story either. We don't get to find out how he got these powers. And I thought that's where you were going, because each episode starts with a sort of flashback that has a cold open flashback. And I thought that's where you were going. Convention would dictate that's where these shows go. And you didn't do that. And I love that.
Thank you, Chris. That was something that was hard always, because there was a lot of people, even in our writers' room, other writers will be like, well, we should just see that moment, the first time he got the powers and what that felt like. And I was like, I really don't want to. I know it's hard. I know it would solve some of our issues, you know, and give our audience sort of a different viewpoint of Simon. But like, to me, I kept feeling like Simon doesn't know where they came from. And the whole point of the show is that he doesn't want them to define who he is. And the more we you know, try to make that what the show is about how he got powers or what his powers are about, the less it is about the thing we were trying to make a show about, which is about the entertainment industry and somebody who is trying, who's pursuing a big dream, and another person who's, you know, maybe has their last shot of ever getting the thing that they ever wanted out of, you know, being an actor. So, that to me was the show. And, the superpowers were the obstacle. They were the thing that was in the way. And that's how I wanted us as writers and creators to look at them as well.
That's really interesting. And so did you ever wobble a little bit? Did you ever yield a little bit and have something in your pocket just in case?
We definitely kicked around concepts in the writer's room of what it would look like if we did that scene. And sometimes it was just for our knowledge to, and then there were times when certain members of our staff would be like, but wouldn't it be great to see that moment right here? And I'd be like, no, I don't want to see that moment. I really don't. That was as close as we ever came to doing, what would in a sense be a traditional origin story of powers. But one of the things I will say, when I started our writer's room, I had written a pilot and sort of a season long arc, but I wanted all our writers on day one to sort of put all that aside and not think about it, not let it cloud what we're doing here. And I asked them what was the moment from their childhood or whatever along the journey where they decided they wanted to be a writer or creator. Because to me, that's what the show is. Why are you an artist? What started that spark for you to want to, because it's not easy. It's not, you know, to get to that writer's room and around that table at Marvel, that was a long journey for anybody who was there. And you're up against a lot of no's and a lot of adversity. So what was it for each one of them? What brought us to Hollywood? Why are we storytellers? That is what the show is. And that is our, and we do get that origin story. That's the story we focus on for Simon, which is doled out through those flashbacks.
But it is fascinating as well. I mean, in terms of how you approached fans' expectations of this and neatly sidestepping Simon's origin is one thing as well, but also, you know, you have his brother to contend with, and his brother in this is an antagonist in a very, very different way than I think people will be expecting. They'll be expecting you to set up the Grim Reaper or something like that, and instead Eric's an obstacle in a different way.
Yes, and it was funny, when we cast Demetrius Gross, who plays Eric Williams, who's terrific in the show, he was very excited about being the Grim Reaper, and I kept having to be like, we're not going to do that, you know, Demetrius, I promise, it's a great role, but it's not that. And there was many times when, even when we did like title design, there was a moment where we went out to different companies to like do opening sequence of titles, and we'd shared the first episode with them, and they were all like, oh, it's so cool how this starts. And then they kept presenting us with what they expected the rest of the Marvel show to be, and I kept having to say like, no, I promise, this show is not gonna do that, like it's not. And so it was a lot of people's expectations, not even just in terms of the fan base that we were sort of thinking about, but just internally, a lot of, you know, having to explain to people who were involved in the project, we're never going to then have a villain reveal in the third act. We're not building to a big fight sequence. I promise. I promise. I promise. And I'm really glad that everyone went on that journey with us, Demetrius included. And I hope that the fans out there will go on this journey with us.
So let's break into it. Let's break it down a little bit as well in terms of how you parceled that out throughout the episodes. Going into this, I'd interviewed Yaya for the magazine. Obviously, he said nothing. You'll be delighted to know. But I genuinely went into this not sure whether Simon had already had his powers whenever we meet him, or whether this was going to be a thing where Von Kovac takes him on this journey and he gets his powers in the course of becoming Wonder Man. He actually becomes Wonder Man. And obviously in the first episode, you clearly indicate that he has powers, but it's very, very subtle how you turn it up in terms of the notches in various episodes. In episode 3, he destroys his mother's kitchen table. In episode 5, he has a super-powered fight, but it's sloppy and slapdash, and he doesn't know what the hell he's doing. And then, of course, episode 7 is like, oh, Jesus, this man is seriously powerful. Can you talk about turning it up in increments in that way?
Yes, we played a lot in that first episode with how much to show. There, we looked at that moment where he's sitting in that audition and spinning out, and we see a little bit of the eye twitching that goes beyond just a normal twitch into something supernatural. That was a dial we were never quite sure of. And then that other moment after his girlfriend leaves his apartment was something we came to later. It was another tease that wasn't originally in the script. It was originally in that script. After she storms out of his apartment, he goes into the bathroom and writes down the last line she said to him as she left in case he wanted to use it for a role. And that was something that was a little too hard for people to swallow, too upfront. We had to make Simon more likable than that. So anyway, it was it was something that we looked at constantly. But one of the things that was fun when we got to episode 7 was there was no concern from Marvel internally about how strong Simon could be, because he's in this other part of their of the MCU where it doesn't matter if he's maybe he's stronger than Captain Marvel. He could be. They're open to that idea. There's something really fun about one of the most powerful characters in the MCU being somebody who's never going to use those powers the way people want him to. He wants to use them on his terms, and often they get in his way. But I don't think Simon Williams is ever going to become a hero in the traditional sense. I don't think that's his journey. Maybe he will get involved in bigger conflicts, probably on his own terms, is what I would guess.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's really fascinating as well, what you were saying about him spinning out. There are obviously moments, I want to talk about the final episode in a second, but from the moment we meet him, this is a guy who gets in his own way, and he's absolutely in his own head. And the entire 8 episodes is about getting him to a place where he no longer gets in his way, that he feels, I don't know, the pressure of, you know, that essentially he's born to play this role. And once he plays his role, that's it for him. There's nowhere else to go after that.
Yes. I mean, I think one of the things we sort of wanted to tap into for Simon is this feeling like he's got all this stuff to prove. He knows that he's talented, and he's desperate for other people to realize that. And that is the problem, right? It's that desperation to make it so clear, even if I'm doing 3 lines on American Horror Story, I'm going to stand out in a way on this show that no one can deny it. And it's not that he's wrong about those things he's trying to do. It's just that he's not sort of having perspective on how he's part of a different machine. And one of the things, so, yes, you're right. By the end of this season, Trevor is the person. This relationship with Trevor is something that for the first time in Simon's life gets him out of his head and helps him come to terms with his own creative process. But to me, the reason the finale doesn't end with that movie premiere is because the thing that Simon has realized is that when he gets what he thought he wanted, it's feeling empty because Trevor's not there. And that the thing he thought he wanted and needed is not the thing he really needed. And the thing he really needed was a relationship with somebody that brought him out of his head and out of his self and made him a little less selfless of a person. And so that's where we leave him at the very end.
I love also that he uses acting. Acting is his superpower in a way to get to Trevor in the first place.
That's exactly right. When we finished our writer's room, I had the first act of that finale. I knew what it was, and I knew that how the very end of the season ended. I knew that Simon was going to break Trevor out of prison, and I knew that the first act was going to end with him at that premiere. But I didn't know what happened for 2 acts of this finale, and I was like, I was really freaked out. I was like, I don't have the end of the show. And it took me, as you're saying, a moment to realize that Simon does have a toolkit, right? He is an actor, and he's just got this little bit of fame. And how can he use those things on his terms to do the thing he needs to do in this moment and work a plan? And I love the idea of keeping the audience a little step behind him on this process, and hopefully not reveal too much about for them to not know too be too far ahead of what was going on. And hopefully it's a satisfying moment when we all when the pieces come together, we'll realize what Simon's been up to for most of this episode.
Because it is, it's a real slow burn with Chuck.
Yes.
It really Chuck. Is.
And I that was the key, was like, how long can I string everyone along and get to the point where everyone's like, what the fuck are we doing in this finale? What why are we hanging out with Chuck for all these pages? But hopefully we've earned our audience's trust enough at that point that they'll stick with us for those 15 minutes of that episode.
It's great because it feels like a short film. It feels like something that's coming out of left field. I had no idea where the hell you were going with it, but I was along for the ride. And then, of course, once Simon does get into the prison, by the way, for the MCU completists, what is that prison?
So we see that prison in She-Hulk. It's the same facility that is flashed to. We use the same graphics for that, but it is the DODC's state-of-the-art prison. It's just for supernatural, superpowered individuals.
Okay, and Trevor.
And Trevor, well, yes. Good point.
They know what they've got with Trevor. They know they're just locking up just an English actor. God bless them. But once Simon gets into that prison, that's a line that cannot be uncrossed. And there's a sense, almost that he's coming out to the world in a way as a superpowered being. And there's that sort of that element, that aspect of the show runs through it as well, that this is a guy who has a secret that he feels if he is open to people about his secret, then it'll severely impact his ability to do what he loves to do. And I think there's a lot of people around the world who will feel, who will relate with that. I mean, is that something you can talk about? And you know, was that something that was on your mind as you were in the writer's room?
I mean, certainly it is who it is so much about. So central to how I understand Simon is this feeling that, I mean, so originally, you know, when this project came to me, Sir Ben Kingsley was already involved. Destin Daniel Cretton was there to co-create, and we had no idea who Simon Williams was. And Marvel was like, maybe he gets superpowers, maybe he has them already. There's not a particular run of the comics that we want to look at, but we want to write about the entertainment industry. So for me, the big question was, what is Simon's relationship to superpowers if he has them? And what is relationship to acting? And I stumbled along a profile of a very famous actor who's terrific and so talented, but has a process that is very difficult. And he drives a lot of people crazy who work with him. At the end of the day, he creates something incredible, but he takes himself very seriously. And I thought, if you gave that actor, this real life person, superpowers, he's not putting on a cape and flying around trying to save people. He wants to win an Academy Award. He wants to be Daniel Day-Lewis, you know? And I was like, once I figured that out for Simon, I realized, okay, the powers are this thing that makes us have a TV show. It makes, it creates interest from the DODC. It creates, these bigger than life stakes for our characters. But as far as Simon is concerned, he's an artist. Right? Yeah. Being superpowers don't help you, perform a monologue. And why can't Simon choose what he wants for his own life? Right? Just because there's these things that happen to him or these circumstantial things about where he came from or his origin, that shouldn't be how Simon gets to define his role in his life or in the greater good. And, that is very much a part of Simon's journey and a part of what the show is about. And I hope people will connect to that feeling.
There you go, folks. That was Andrew Guest talking about Wonder Man. And if you want to further connect to that feeling, then there's about another half hour or so of that interview, plus a big old dollop of myself, Helen O'Hara, James Dyer, and Amon Warman getting into the show and throwing around all kinds of wild claims and unspeakably terrible opinions. It's over on our Wonder Man Spoiler Special, all 2+ hours of it. It's available now, of course, to all Spoiler Special subscribers. If you don't subscribe, you should give it a whirl, as there are new Spoiler Specials all the time, adding to our bulging library of amazing interviews with world-class filmmakers and, let's be honest, bits where it's us. And it's just £3.49 a month. Go to empire.supportingcast.fm where you can sign up, and also sign up to Pilot TV as well, if that's your bag, you sickos. Okay, That's enough interviews for 1 week, except, of course, on the main Empire Podcast Weekly show, the Mothership Show, there is a cracking chat between myself and Send Help stars Dylan O'Brien and Rachel McAdams. That is tons of fun. And there's also Team Empire talking about EGOTs, the week's movie news, and all the reviews you could possibly need to help you in your movie-going choices this week. Right, that is it. I am out of here. Thanks for listening. See you next time. Bye-bye.